Everyone has a story. How they got here, where they met along the way, the choices they made, the dreams they are chasing. Welcome to Anthologies of Hope. Welcome back to Anthologies of Hope, and thank you all so very much for joining us week to week. It means the world to everyone at Anthologies of Hope when we get the great and uplifting feedback from each of our episodes. As always, I am your host, Rick Osowski, and I am not a mental health professional in any way, simply a mental health advocate with a passion for storytelling. I can't say how grateful both Amanda and I are for the amazing reception that her episode last week has received. More people than ever have reached out in the past week, shared even more with us as a result of the IVF discussion in her episode, and we could not be more thankful and grateful for those interactions. Picking up where we left off with our traditional episode format from last season, we are continuing our interviews with members of the Heart Camp family. If you're not familiar with Heart Camp, we dive deep into the ins and outs of it in our first two episodes. But as a quick refresher, Heart Camp is the brainchild of Jamie Torkowski and a two-day workshop focusing on authenticity, writing, bringing your heart to work, and mental health. For more info on Heart Camp, including very soon upcoming dates in Melbourne, Florida, May 4th and 5th, you can check out heartcampwithjamie.com for details. And now we get to this week's guest, which is me, as weird as that sounds. I want to thank my wonderful wife, Amanda, for flip-flopping roles and literally positions on the couch to fulfill the role of interviewer for this episode. She definitely came with some questions that I did not expect and love how this conversation went. It's always weird to figure out what is your elevator pitch. Who are you distilled into 30 seconds? It's even more difficult to figure out a cohesive elevator pitch for Anthologies of Hope because it seems unfair to distill it down to just a mental health podcast. Similarly, it's always difficult to get all of your story out there within a few minutes when someone asks what brought you to the mental health movement. That's one of the main reasons Anthologies of Hope exists, to give our guests the platforms their stories deserve to share as far, as wide, and as long as they need to. And as such, that happens to be my story this week. Instead of overlaying my story on top of each week's guest, I was saving it all up for when we'd eventually get to my turn. We cover my experience with the effects of suicide at an early age, as a young adult and late 20s, along with walking through a number of other factors that made me into the Enneagram 2 that I am today. As with all stories, we didn't get every facet of mine captured here, but there is more than enough to understand why I will not be quiet in the mental health discussion and why I will keep fighting to break the silence and break the stigma for my loved ones. Moving on to our Season 2 playlist, which will be available at anthologiesofhope.com/playlist, you'll still be able to find our Season 1 playlist under our user account on Spotify, as well as anthologiesofhope.com/playlist-season-1. Similar to last week, we're breaking all the rules when it comes to songs this week. I picked two Volbeat songs off of their latest concert album and explained in detail at the end of the interview why they mean so much to me. Amanda chose Shinedown's Amaryllis after having to unexpectedly contribute, but she could not have picked a more perfect song. As I mentioned in response to her selection, having the lyrics of this song tattooed on my wrist helped keep me balanced in both the highest highs and the lowest lows. Or in the speak of To Write Love in Our Arms, it helps me balance both the heavy and the light. Additionally, we're throwing Alter Bridges' Before Tomorrow Comes onto the playlist for this week as well, as it plays such a pivotal role in my loss, grieving, and coping experience due to suicides in my life, which I explain in the first half of the episode in detail. Each week, we'd like to remind you that if you're in a time of crisis, we'll be covering a range of potentially difficult topics. Please use this as a warning to seek help and come back to listen once you are in a more positive season. If you are in need of help, an abundance of international resources can be found on the Find Help pages from To Write Love in Our Arms and Hope for the Day. To Write Love in Our Arms can be found at twloha.com/find-help, and Hope for the Day can be found at hftd.org/find-help. As always, you can find us at anthologiesofhope.com, on Facebook and Instagram as Anthologies of Hope, on Twitter as Anthologies Pod, or email us directly at anthologiesofhope, all one word, no punctuation, @gmail.com. Like, subscribe, and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. So for everyone asking, here's my story, my journey to mental health advocacy, and the reason for this podcast to exist. This week's episode, Anthologies of Hope, Rick Osowski. People have definitely been asking for a, I guess, flip-flopped experience from my point of view here. So it's one that I've been thinking of. And so far, about 15 plus hours recorded specifically for anthologies recordings and episodes, but also, I mean, as we'll touch on, you know, many countless more individual conversations, both your untimely deemed pillow talk when I'm ready to go to sleep and you're ready to talk, as well as, you know, the number of friends that we have between us that still come to us for advice, obviously rightly so, just conversations as well, but then also friends of friends, coworkers, colleagues, and all of that stuff. So it's one where mostly every episode so far has been, well, I wouldn't say mostly, I would say every episode so far has been the case for sharing the guest story. So I didn't want to jump in or kind of steer too much of that or kind of overtake that. So I was kind of compartmentalizing as much as I could for my own episode as we were planning to do this over the winter holidays. So kind of just putting this here. So, I mean, I have a little bit of a brain pattern for what I'm expecting to kind of have as far as this discussion, where it's going to go and what we're going to do. But there's probably other things that you want to jump in on or interject or kind of have some of those conversations too. So
I do, for sure. I mean, my first thought is that I'd love to hear how the brainchild of Anthologies of Hope came to be. But I think before I can ask you that question, I think it would be really great if you could talk a little bit about how you ended up in this mental health advocacy space and kind of what your personal experiences and your journey has been to get to this point, because obviously it started way before I met you.
And that was the beginning of what I had started piecing together as part of my story. And that's a story I've told many times over. And as we start to get in more and more into the second season of Anthologies of Hope and into the additional seasons where we're just going to have more and more folks coming in from the general mental health community, hopefully we can coordinate that to do some recording locally with a lot of the great mental health resources that we have in the Chicago area that I've met through a lot of the work we've been doing with Hope for the Day, both at Sip of Hope in Logan Square and elsewhere. But also it becomes a place where between you and I, we've had countless conversations one-on-one with many people. But then if we have the same conversation with 10 people, that's only those 10 conversations. But if we have 10 conversations and record those, and each of those people end up sharing those recorded conversations in the form of a podcast with 10 other people, I only have a minor in math, but I think that ends up getting us to 100 conversations as opposed to just the single 10 conversations. And then we're not worrying about burnout or losing track of anything and things like that. So absolutely, that's kind of the goal that I had here. And the brainchild, as far as sitting in Heart Camp in Los Angeles and just having that kind of epiphany, where knowing a lot of the magnitude of the stories that were shared both in Florida originally, seeing some of the folks that had joined the second Florida group, and then just knowing some of the road that folks had traveled to get to LA, and then seeing what they've done since that time has been pretty amazing. So that was the main goal for me as far as the genesis of Anthologies of Hope and building a platform to put this together for other folks to be able to, you know, share their story and figure out what they would need. So a part of my journey there, I mean, unfortunately, gets to a lot of interaction with suicide. So nothing me personally, but it's not something that hasn't impacted me directly or my family directly, and as well as my larger circle of friends. So if we're doing it chronologically, which I think most of the episodes that we've done so far have been, probably the most fine-tuned one has been Jenny's as far as hitting all the steps chronologically. But that's one where I also see a lot of similarity in my story with Jenny's story as far as experiences and coming and going and how we react to certain situations. So that's not unheard of. But starting out really young, I was a only child, and in my house, I was often alone growing up based off of having divorced parents and trying to think a decent amount of of folks have that we've talked with had divorced parents. I don't know numbers specifically, but it ended up being where both my parents were working to support me in either way, which obviously makes total and complete sense, and I'm forever grateful for. But having no siblings, I was often left to my own devices, and usually that meant, you know, video games or sports or whatever. And after doing homework for a pretty decent rural school system in northeastern Maryland, but it wasn't like it was anything that was super challenging or anything. I wasn't spending a lot of time kind of diving into extracurriculars that were school related and or anything that was just, you know, extra homework or needing to spend that much time on it. Usually I was getting yelled at for doing my homework in class and not taking actually any books home with me.
I'm not actually surprised about that.
And so the fact that I was usually done all my homework in class and then the teachers would catch me leaving without books, but then they would see me turning my homework in. So they wanted me to make sure I was paying attention in class. But I would posit that if I'm doing my homework and getting all the grades, why do I need to pay attention? But that's an argument for another point. And probably something that we'll have to do in, you know, 8 years plus 6 months or something. But that's, you know, neither here nor there. So I was usually spending a lot of time on my own. The only problem was everybody else in our neighborhood had siblings of at least two or three. So I was constantly looking to interact with all my friends in the neighborhood. And right now I can't, going up and down the street and through the neighborhood, I can't remember a single person in the neighborhood that was in our friend group that did not have siblings.
So obviously that has been super impactful on not just like your mental health and your, the way that you relate to other people, but the person that you've become and the family that you want to have.
Yeah. It's always where, and I think I talked with Erin about this in season one, where it ends up being like, she's got a shit ton on her plate. And for me, that's always the thing to do, because it was, if I didn't have a lot on my plate, I was stuck being alone. And so it was a case where if I had a lot on my plate, it meant I was interacting with other people. And so that kind of was always the drive there of going out and organizing communities, whether it was constantly going across the street and seeing if kids wanted to play video games, or going up, and we live down the street from a church parking lot, and during the week in the summer, there's not much going on there, so we were basically just playing roller hockey all day. Things like that. So constantly trying to organize community, and that really never changed while going into, that really never changed going into my formative years, where once I started playing Magic, that's something where always trying to organize, you know, friends getting together to play Magic, always trying to organize certain types of events, trying to figure stuff out and just get people together to do stuff together has always been one of my main drives. So around the, well, probably shortly after I picked up Magic, that was my first experience with the impact of suicide. And it's similar, or it's oddly similar to where with some of the recent news events, Dr. Ford and some of the confirmation hearings with the Supreme Court Justice, she had mentioned something where you just remember something based on the foundational principles of memory and how it's ingrained in certain things there. Sure. So I don't remember exactly how old I was, but I remember pretty much everything else about the outcome of the first impact of suicide that my family had that I was aware of. So I was somewhere between 10 and 14, but this was a first cousin of mine on my dad's side. And it was something where, just say 20 years ago at this point, and there really was no concept at the time that there was anything else besides the stigma associated with suicide. So like I think like in that time we've come obviously a long way, but I don't remember the exact age I was, but I remember going into the funeral home and being on both sides of my family being Christian oriented. And so this was kind of a new concept for you and I, once we started interacting with friends and family and having to go to funerals where there were open caskets and some of the viewing there. So like, I still remember exactly what my cousin looked like at the time, but not like, and having that kind of view as opposed to what I remember of her in pictures and things. But like, I don't remember many more of the details. I remember the backstory and kind of what she said, what my dad relayed to me that she was talking to her uncle earlier in the week and some of the things that were going on, but it constantly was reoccurring where it was like, she never said it was that bad. She said it was a hard time, et cetera, et cetera.
Which unfortunately I think is something that a lot of people who have been impacted by suicide of a loved one can relate to very heavily. You know, looking at that as just one incident in your life and now also being an adult while you look at it, how do you feel like your parents handled the way that they explained things to you? And did they give you enough information, too much information, not enough?
Well, I mean, I think that's kind of almost a side effect or the reason for, again, what I do remember about the situation versus what I don't. So, like, I don't remember the age and date time specifics, but I remember exactly what one of my aunts was wearing. I remember the exact conversation we had when we walked into the room. I remember the, like, exact setup of chairs. I remember where people were standing. I remember the procession from the funeral home to the burial site and, like, where it is. And then, I've mentioned this on a number of other episodes, I'm not very religious, but I've more recently come around to a lot of the spirituality thing. But I'm also a very curious person as to the concept of deja vu. Sure. And so there's very many times where I'll be in an area where I'm like, this is the first time I've ever been here, but I remember that hill very specifically. Yeah. So, like, I know the exact hillside that she's buried on, and I remember, like, a lot of that view, and that's come into play where it ends up being a visual that overlaps a lot. So it's something where it wasn't anything that they by any means hid anything from me, but it was something where the language used is different than the language used now to discuss suicide.
Sure.
And so it's a concept where I think just because of that is something where that's where I remember more around the surrounding things as opposed to the specifics.
Do you feel like in a way, like maybe your parents were also trying to protect you a little bit from the realities of it?
Well, I would imagine, but I mean, it was at this point being at that age, I was living with my dad. I mean, he was pretty frank. I mean, just as with everything else. So there wasn't like there was anything being hid. And it was definitely the conversation where there's really only two times probably now three times I've seen my dad cry.
And, well, I've been there for at least one.
Well, a couple. And so that was, and so it wasn't like we never, and that, in some of the other conversations that we've had on anthologies, it was a conversation where it wasn't something where we never shared feelings or emoted or anything like that, but it wasn't like there were safe spaces or we never had check-ins or things like that. It was just kind of matter-of-factly about it, and that was perfectly fine. So there really wasn't anything that was hidden, but it was something that was just kind of, you know, point of fact. And as we mentioned with Jenny, it was just, it's not judging anything. It was just a statement of fact, which I think was good for me, because otherwise, if at that time, if he tried to beat around the bush or sugarcoat it or whatever, it would have made me more curious, or it would have kind of just made me dig in more. And so, but yeah, so I mean, I'm thankful for that, where I think that also the way he was super frank with me about it at that point, just putting it out there as to exactly what it was, has set me up to have this conversation now,
which and is,
the,
I think,
the
really
one over the,
cool.
the past 20 years.
Absolutely. I think that's really cool to look back on. And I certainly have a very different relationship with the conversations of mental health and suicide awareness and mental illness with my family than that. You know, having lived through a lot of things and having experiences on my own, it definitely has been a difficult conversation, and my parents have not been as easy to talk to per se, because they just come from a different place of understanding. But, you know, looking at what you just shared, did that event change things for you? Did it impact like the way that you thought or the things around you? Or was it, you know, just one event in a string of events that kind of impacted your story?
The conversation we had around that was definitely one that set me up for many further conversations, and one that unfortunately I became, you know, all too familiar with in my family surrounding the suicide and mental health, and not one that many of them wanted to talk about, frankly. But they, again, it was something where we brushed things under the covers and things like that. So that kind of fast forwards us to, I would say, the most impactful piece of, or the most impactful event in my life that suicide has made a hit on, and that's with my cousin Tom. And he was, growing up, he was, depending on the year, well, it doesn't really change depending on what time, what part of the year we're in, but he was about 9.5 years older than me. But again, being an only child, he was like an older brother to me. So it wasn't something where I had any ability to have, again, outside of the neighborhood and playing with friends or anything like that. Like, he was the one I looked up to for just about everything. Sure. For sports, for music. I mean, I still remember going to see Beauty and the Beast, the animated movie, with him and his girlfriend, and sitting in the back of his Monte Carlo SS to go to the movies and stuff like that. So it was always, I was the annoying younger brother he probably never wanted. But I remember, like, him beating me up and picking on me and stuff like that. But that was because I wanted to be around him all the time and playing with him. And I mean, looking now, that's the same way that I react or interact with my younger cousins and extended family and things like that. And so that was a very formidable relationship that I had. And so I had known about some issues with mental health in his past, but it wasn't something that knew the magnitude of it. And so, you know, I'll still remember the phone call I got from my mom that was basically a blood-curdling scream on the phone, where I was at the wedding of my best friend that I've known since I was 2. We were roommates in college, you know, grew up together, did everything together, played football together, went to Penn State together. So we were at the morning after brunch from his wedding. And I got a phone call from my mom that was just a blood-curdling scream, and you could barely make it out. So I thought, like, they were at the wedding the night before and going home, and I thought they were in some sort of accident. But then she was just basically saying, like, he did it. And so that was, my cousin had died by suicide the night before, being trying to be conscious of using preferred language as opposed to the common nomenclature that does project shame and ownership of a lot of this stuff. But it was something where that was something that I didn't expect, just because it hadn't really been talked about. And just kind of figuring out what was going on. And then we were near Harrisburg, had to get down to Maryland, where we were staying with my in-laws at the time. And then I think it was the next day we went back up to Pennsylvania to gather with everyone and figure stuff out. But I just basically just remember, as soon as we got back to my in-laws, it was just sitting there, and I just went out back and I talked to my mom, I talked to my aunt, and then I basically sat there. And again, just one of those pieces of what memory ingrains into your brain, where I just listened to Alter Bridges' Before Tomorrow Comes on repeat. And it was just one where there were just so many hooks, so many parts of the song, so many pieces of the lyrics, where I just sat there and was angry and cried and everything. And I mean, I think, like, at that night, that was where, like, I processed most of it. So then went up the next day and started, you know, helping out. My aunt was a lot more surprisingly calm than I expected her to be. So I don't know if that was a combination of knowing something was coming, or
shock.
Hopefully, depending on conversations we can have, and if she's feeling up to it, we can have that conversation with her at another time, because she's also been the model for how I've looked at dealing with suicide.
Yeah.
And somebody who I mean, and it's, again, it's not something, even with as outspoken as we are about it, I've never had a frank conversation with her about that. So, but it's something where she's, again, she's not played it down. She's not, you know, skirted the conversation. She's made it known that, you know, that's what happened. But then she's also, to a person, embraced, like, every single person that was in her son's life. And that was something that really stuck out to me, because that again is, to do that, you're still lifting that person up. You're still keeping their memory around, as opposed to, like, shutting it down, putting it away, and, you know, never to be heard from again. So there was a lot there where, again, I am the person I am today because of my cousin. And the main thing there, and the main thing that really resonated me with our episode with Jenny in season one, was when she said there was a feeling of loss that she had, and she never wanted anybody to feel that way again. Like, she never wanted anybody to feel like that. And so for me, there's, when it comes to loss like that, it's not something where, for whatever reason, I feel a deep sense of grief, a deep sense of loss, or anything like that. I feel more or less nothing. And so it's not the, I definitely have highs and lows in every day of life and everything, you know, between superficial stuff like sports teams winning championships to, you know, going through the IVF process that we talked about, the ups and downs there. Like, there's definitely highs and lows there. But when it comes to like physical concrete loss in life with people, like, it's not like good, bad, high, low, small, little. It's just like there's nothing for me. And that is what I fight for. That is where I put all of my energy, all my passion, to make sure that nobody else ever feels that type of loss in their life, where it's just this black hole, and where it's, you know, pick your superhero metaphor of choice, whether it's the Speed Force or the time stream or whatever you want, as far as just something getting sucked in there where there's just, it's nothing can escape that. So that's really what I've always fought for, to be a obnoxious, pain in the ass, squeaky wheel, elephant in the room type person, to always have that conversation, because I don't want the person on the other side of the fence to basically have a person help them become who they are just disappear.
Yeah.
And so that's always been where I've fought and what I've pushed for.
That definitely makes sense. In the time since then, have there been other people in your life that have struggled with mental health issues that have impacted you? Have you struggled with mental health issues? Why don't you talk a little bit about sort of what has gone on since Tom's passing?
I mean, unfortunately, since then, it's something that has continued to affect us, or affect my family, affect me for multiple reasons, or I guess just on multiple occasions, not necessarily multiple reasons, where another friend from high school ended up completing suicide. And it was something where him and I would connect and talk like nothing was wrong. And we would sit there, and it was this point I was working a development job at a team. So I was going into the office pretty regularly, and even at this point carpooling. And so I was usually up at 5 or 5:30 meeting my buddy, like in the parking lot at 6, 6:20. And then we'd be in the office by like 6:30. And so that was the greatest time to be in the office, because nobody else was there, so you could be productive. So I was doing my most productive coding between the hours of like 6:30 and 8:30. So that was awesome. But it also sucked when I would be watching Californication on Sunday nights on Showtime, still one of my favorite premium shows ever. And either I would post a quote from the main character, or he would, and then we'd respond, and then we'd just catch up on Messenger, and then we talk until like 12 o'clock or 1 o'clock in the morning, going from there into other random movies, into the depths of, or the pros and cons of, the X-Men and all this other random stuff. And then this was when I was in North Carolina, and so I'd always go home around the holidays to Maryland. We'd try to catch up, and then it would always just end up canceling or getting stuff blown off and things like that. And we'd always made plans or talked here and there, and then just never did. And then, you know, come to find out June 2013, he had completed suicide, to the surprise of pretty much everyone. Because, again, he was also one of the prototypical, he was the Robin Williams character. Yeah. He was the one that made sure everyone else in the room was happy. He was the one that was the life of the party. He was the one that, you know, everybody wanted to be because of his social qualities. But then obviously there's so much hiding behind that mask. I've had other family members that we've lost due to both checked and unchecked mental illness, where, again, some can only keep fighting so long. And then, you know, other close friends where battling through depression and just hiding it, and due to the shame and stigma, and then having that bleed over into addiction, having that end up being a case where it's a situation that, you know, it's something you, at that point, it ends up being almost a too little too late type thing. It's a confluence of events that is even medically, and with all the science we have now, there's not much you can do to bring that back from. So that's why, again, talk about it early, break the stigma, get out there in front of it, because everybody is going to have problems. Some people, that's going to be resolved by physical activity. Some people, that's going to be resolved by talk therapy. Some people, that's going to be resolved by medication. Again, none of that is in any way different, shape, or form as physical health and physical kind of medicine. So it just ends up being where the more conversations we have around those spaces, that's the, it just kind of, as we experience, as it's kind of like experiencing those hits, and the individuals and loved ones in our lives and our circles end up dealing with those, it just makes me want to double down and kind of keep going that much further.
Absolutely. And I mean, you've definitely shed some light on the things in your journey that were catalysts for change, and why you push forward on this journey, and what you hope to give to others or prevent others from experiencing. You know, looking back over all the things that you just shared and the spaces in between them, are there any resources that you felt were really beneficial on your journey, or resources that were missing, or resources you wish you had, you know, during the last decade and a half, 2 decades?
The interesting thing is, as far as the timing with a lot of it, where I think it recently coming up on, or recently passing the 10-year anniversary of my cousin's death, and then just sadly, due to knowing the timing of things and some of the other stuff, that was around the same time of when the iPhone came out. So I think the kind of the app culture that we're in now is, with as much of a negative issue and as much of a shitstorm as it can create, I think it is something that is very positive, where there are things like one of your favorite tools with the Calm app. So for personal, like on the spot, I need it right now type things. But even then, I mean, with crisis text line and a lot of that stuff, and using the tools and technology to do that. But things like Talkspace, and there's another one, there's a more recent one that's another app base that'll connect you with therapists and counselor help directly. So I think those things now are much more readily available for folks. So both folks in crisis at the time, as well as those affected that needing to deal with things, both either dealing with loved ones who are still alive and going through this in crisis to understand how they can help their loved ones, but also stay healthy and in control themselves, as well as for folks that have lost people. And I mean, a lot of that can be found and immediately connected to through a lot of the programs and the organizations that we support, like To Write Love in Our Arms and Hope for the Day, who have Find Help pages. So those are things that now, looking back, where what we've hit, or, you know, the loss I've experienced over the last 10 years is something where, using those resources now, you never know what could have been saved, prevented, or whatever.
No, and I think that I would never even ask that question. It's more that, like, if you could give past you some tools to cope, or past your family tools to cope, like, are those tools that were available then, or are they tools that have been developed?
Well, it ends up being a case where, and it's one of the sayings that Johnny Boucher has from Hope for the Day, and one of the founding kind of sentiments there is, you need to meet people where they're at. And so similarly, you need to bring resources to people where they are at.
I'm a huge proponent of that as well.
If people are in their phone, and as much as the old curmudgeons want to bitch about kids just sitting around on their phone, as well as, you know, a number of other things, and but it is what it is. It's an app culture. It's easy to access and everything there, but and being on the cutting edge of every piece of phone technology that there ever was, there's not much out there that, at the time, using the old 3GP type pages, you're not going to surf the mobile web to try to find mental health resources. You're just going to throw your phone against the wall and keep going. So now it just, those resources weren't not there. they just weren't as easily accessible. So
I think that's a really good point.
So the and again, you didn't know, like you had to, the barrier to entry was too high. Like you had those resources, the same resources, or I would say evolved resources still exist in schools today, but like you still had the ability to go to counselors and things like that in schools, but there was still a super massive stigma associated with it.
Absolutely.
So, and then now even as we were watching a comedian on a random Netflix series, which I don't even know which one it was at the moment, but he was saying, you know, kids are coming out earlier and earlier these days, and there's conversations and joke or a punchline, and one of his is not a punchline, but just a setup for kids coming out at age 7 or 9 or something. And so having those kids are having access to the internet, having access to these resources at a much earlier age, it ends up being a case where those same kids, it ends up being a case where having these kids have access to this stuff is going to save so many lives. And so, I mean, it's a shame that it took us this long to get there, but we knew those resources were there, but it wasn't a place to kind of get them into the hands of people that were needed. So similar to Twitter, where it does unfortunately cause a lot of problems depending on who's using it. It is something that can be very useful to be able to have these resources that are out there, and much more just lower the bar and make it easier for people to use something. Because again, that's why.
Well, it's about accessibility.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Let's switch gears a little bit. And let's talk a little bit about Tart Love and Herms and Heart Camp. And if you could share a little bit about your journey with Tart Love and Herms, you know, kind of just when it started and how you became involved and what led you ultimately to participate in Heart Camp and what that has changed for you since then.
So I, unlike pretty much everybody else in that, I would say to a person we've interviewed for Anthology so far, I did not follow Tart Love on MySpace. I may have had a MySpace page, but I didn't ever do anything with it. I only joined Facebook in 2005, like my senior year of college, because there was some movie that was doing previews that you could only find trailers for if you had a Facebook page.
Interesting.
And so that was originally why I got on that bandwagon, which I think it was an X-Men movie now that I'm thinking about it, but that's neither here nor there. So it wasn't something where I was on there from day one, but I did end up doing I ended up doing a Warrior Dash with a buddy I played hockey with, and it was just him and I. We tried to recruit more people. Other people chickened out. So we drove down from Raleigh to Charlotte, and then there was a group of, I would say, probably 6 or 7 people that had the black Tart Love and Herms shirts. Actually, they were, now that I think about it, they were the A-frame tank tops. And so it was just the fact that they were all like together, and it caught my eye. So as they were walking by, the 3, 6'5", probably 220-ish Marines who were dressed up as Mario, Luigi, and Princess Peach, I could see that, you know, they were together as a team, and it was of something of significance, and not just something that they made. So when we got back home later that night, I Googled it and, you know, found the story. So this was, I don't remember the exact time. It was either 2008 or 2010, around that time frame. But it was something where it caught my eye, and again, the story resonated, and just seeing the website, and they were much more than just MySpace at that point. And just the kind of the story resonated with me based off of the, it had to be later than 2008. So it had to be at least like 2010 based off of the, in relation to Tom's passing. So that was just kind of keep putting on the back burner. And it was something I came back to periodically, just based off of all of the other incidences or the mental health problems that, you know, loved ones, friends, and family were encountering. So I'd come back to it. I wasn't as much of a blog reader, and I also have a feeling that a large majority of the folks who followed the Tart Love blog, or the journey of the Tart Love and Herms blog, are also much more prolific writers than I am.
Always tap that.
And so it ends up being a case where they see themselves writing for that, and I never did. So it was just something where certain topics here or there would catch my eye, but I never really followed along for any specific reason. But it was, you know, again, things that were glad there. And I had maybe like 1 or 2 shirts beforehand, but it was just something that eventually the relevance snowballed based off of how much of the kind of the clanging would keep coming back into my story, or as Terry mentioned and quoted, I don't remember who she quoted in her episode, but kind of the sacred echoes and the fact that it kept popping up in things that were related to me or kind of popping around. So there was something that made a lot of sense that way. So I just followed along there, and then it ended up being a case that you and I ended up connecting through a series of unfortunate events, to borrow both a pop culture term and to put it simply, of a mutual friend. And then I found your blog that was published on Turret Love in Her Arms, and
which was published just 1 week before our paths crossed.
And so that ended up being very serendipitous. And ever since that time, it's been something where the kind of the communication, and both initially, you know, as friends helping a friend and things like that, and then going through and just kind of the growth that it's had. And again, the applicability into our stories, because the more you talk about it, the more other people feel the ability to talk about it. The more you talk about it, the more other people want to talk about it. And so I would say in the 4.5 years that we've known each other, I've had more mental health conversations with friends, family, loved ones than I've had in, you know, the 30 years prior to that.
Do you think that that's somehow reflectant or based upon the partnership we have in the way that that was formed?
I would agree. I mean, I think I would say that's valid. It's also a case where it's the reason this podcast exists. It's the reason why, you know, we'll get to it in a moment, of why once I saw what you had in your heart camp group, it's what I jumped into in ours. And it's a case where seeing the result of just one of those conversations and the positive impact that it has there, and then every time somebody else reached out to kind of keep coming back and keep going, it ended up being a case of positive impact, and having friends come away with, I mean, just friends, family, coworkers that I've worked with on a project maybe once, but then, you know, circling back and saying, you know, so-and-so, or I'm dealing with this or whatever, ends up having those conversations. And at the time, just seeing the positive result of those one-on-one conversations.
Sure.
And it made sense to kind of keep going and keep pushing.
And I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I sort of have felt over the last couple of years that by creating a support system here between the two of us, that I have been more able to provide support to other people, because I know that I'm not really shouldering it alone anymore, that you are technically also shouldering it, even if it's not being funneled through you. And I also feel more confident, because if I don't know where to find someone a resource or what to connect them to, like as a team we do. And so I don't know if you felt like the same experience, but I feel like it's allowed me to be a better and more supportive friend in this realm, in these conversations.
Absolutely. It ends up being a case where for me, it's very similar to a lot of the conversations that happen at Heavy and Light, which is Trey Love in Her Arms annual concert, spoken word kind of get together every year, that we've gone to twice. And actually you've gone to three. Yeah. And we've attended together twice, where there's a lot of, during the spoken word sessions there's a number of other organizations or mental health professionals who are partner pairs. Sure. And so
that's a good point.
So they're, you know, they're spousal partners of some sort, but then they also work together, whether it's both being advocates or clinicians, or being in the same space, but one's administrative or whatever, but it ends up having a space where you're able to have the conversation, bounce stuff off each other, and kind of keep it going there. And it makes it a little bit easier to not take it all on yourself, not burden it all, but have it be a case where you're able to figure out what you need in a constructive way, and to kind of make it
to keep some sort of level of objectivity. I mean, I know for me, like, my empathy goes into overdrive, and I really prefer to carry other people's emotions, but that doesn't always enable me to, like, provide level-headed resources or support to them. And so I feel like that has been really helpful to me, is that you are able to either keep me like straying away from that, or you're able to provide balance when that is how I react. So I completely agree with that.
Well, it helps us balance each other out, because then, again, it was even, I'm trying to remember what podcast I was listening to walking home the other day. Oh, it was, I mean, Dax Shepard, he was on an episode of Pete Holmes, You Made It Weird podcast. And again, that's something I'm so far behind, but we'll get to that on self-care. But he was saying, like, when he goes to AA meetings, he's listening to somebody else up there tell their story. And he's like, if you treated yourself with like 1/10 the grace that you would treat the person who's currently speaking, you'd be in a much better space. And so I think that ends up being applicable here, where when we're trying to handle a situation, or, I mean, there's numerous ones that have come to mind when we've been trying to help friends in crisis for, you know, over the past 3.5 years easily, that it just ends up being a case where for us, it's almost like a game of tennis where we thrive together.
Absolutely.
And we're able to have good ideas back and forth with each other.
Absolutely. I completely agree. So following that same train of thought, how did you end up in the room at Heart Camp?
It was something, again, being a good team, we went to Florida because you wanted to go to the first one. You knew about it. You saw about it. You were following Jamie on social media. And so we went there initially. I was just there in support of you, and also because I have family in the Orlando area, and that being not too far from Orlando, it made sense to go down, see them, and then spend a couple of days there and take a trip. And it's also, even though since I've moved here, the winters haven't been so bad, getting to Florida in the winter isn't something to scoff at. So that was good. So just going there, and then it was kind of a weird roller coaster ride anyway, of being able to be there and then go. You headed straight to Heart Camp with a couple of the other campers, both Kenneth and Sarah, from the airport in Orlando. I went and spent time with my aunt and uncle. We watched the Eagles playoff game where they narrowly defeated the Falcons. And then I drove down and listened to more. Actually, I don't remember if I listened to podcasts or one of the other games or whatever, but that's neither here nor there. And then we went out to breakfast the next morning, saw two adorable puppies at Starbucks, and then found out how much everybody at Heart Camp also loves dogs. And you went and did your Heart Camp thing. I went and played Magic at one of the local comic book stores, comic book game stores. And then Monday, which was day two for you, I was working remotely, which was annoying, but still fine. Because, again, you can work anywhere, or I can work anywhere that has an internet connection. So working there. And then it was just kind of seeing the instant friendship, the instant communication, a lot of the instant community that was there, and seeing a lot of the folks and kind of what people were sharing. And not necessarily since I wasn't ever in the room, but just seeing the conversations that were taking place outside of that room, yeah, just ad hoc and of a casual nature, and having people talk about those things in such a casual way that normally in other company between the two of us, they're whispered or shied, or like, you know, we have to talk about it in a corner or something. So it was inspiring to hear all of those conversations taking place there, and to see a lot of what was happening and a lot of what was kind of going on, in addition to just the content and the programming that Jamie had put together for the program, but just kind of seeing how, again, you're just getting all the ingredients together in the room and then lighting that spark and then watching the bomb explode. So that was my kind of catalyst for wanting to jump into LA. And it was the same exact thing I found there, where it was a case of, again, putting the people in the room that kind of know what they're going after, whether it's being a mental health advocate, whether it's looking to start a nonprofit, whether it's looking to become a better writer, whether it's looking to be authentic and bring your heart to work and all of that stuff. That was really the inspiration for getting there. And it's not something that I would say I'm disappointed in any way, shape, or form.
So I have two questions after that. The first one is, so as you mentioned, we both attended Heart Camp, but we attended at different sessions. I attended January in Florida, and you attended April in LA. Have you thought at all about how it could have or would have been different if we had attended the same one? And how does it make you feel about the fact that we're both attending the Heart Camp reunion next month in Florida?
I mean, I don't think it would have necessarily been bad, but again, it was something where I don't know if we would have gotten the same thing out of it, because you went into Florida with one set of expectations.
I did.
And then I went into LA with a different set of expectations. Absolutely. But it wasn't something where I was in the room where it's like, we're here together.
Right.
But I think it's also a case of seeing what you got out of Florida was inspiration for me to go to LA, as opposed to in your session, there was at least two people that, you know, knew each other and went together.
Right.
Or actually a couple of people that knew each other and went together. And then in my session, there were a couple of people that knew each other ahead of time or, you know, were there together. But even though in those instances, I think they each of those groups had individual reasons for being there.
Right.
Whereas as of last January in Florida, I did not yet have my personal reason to be there.
Which makes total sense. And I thought about that a lot. And I agree. I think that I maybe pushed myself harder or differently to be open and to speak and to say things because you weren't in the room. And I think if you had been in the room, I think I probably would have like whispered under my breath a lot to you or like passed you notes essentially. But I do think now that we both have this really strong foundation that I'm really looking forward to being together for the reunion. And like, I feel like we've both created a voice and a safe space in the community. And that makes me feel like we'll both be in a good place to be our own people while we share that experience.
Which I agree completely, because there's another situation where, similar to the training that I've done recently that Hope for the Day sponsors and one of our Heart Camp family has driven out and went with me. But there was a conversation, I don't remember the setup to the conversation, but it was something where, again, conversation, being an only child, constantly looking for community, etc., and just my physical nature,
yeah.
I tend to go against being a loud, boisterous, overbearing,
which your wife appreciates,
commanding the conversation because I am physically imposing.
Sure.
Like I've always been on, I'm not super tall, but I'm tall enough. And then I've always been on the bigger, broader shouldered, you know, husky side of things. And so it ends up being a case where I'm usually pretty physically imposing no matter where I'm at. And so I tend to, personality wise, I've always tried to be more of a wallflower and let people say what they need to say, because otherwise it ends up being like, as far as however my brain visualizes it or puts it together, it ends up being a case where, like, if I'm physically imposing and dominating the conversation, like, I obviously feel bad. So it ends up being a case where my personality tends to be one that's rather passive. So it, even though I'm out constantly searching for community, it takes me a while to build that up in the physical space. And so that's where I think going back is, you know, a completely different mindset, because it's something where, again, across all the different sessions, folks have established that. I've even been, you know, blown away by a lot of the intermingling or cross-contamination, for the scientific term, of folks like looking at across the different sessions and things like that, and how vocal a lot of the folks are across social media to see a lot of the different pieces come together. So just seeing that and seeing that is something I'm actively looking forward to, again, because it's something we can share. And, you know, I've assimilated into some of the core group that you had for the first Heart Camp group. And then we've had friends come in to Chicago from, you know, my Heart Camp group and some of that. And so it's definitely been something where at this point, kind of going back, it's just the larger family as a whole, as opposed to just the individual sessions.
Sure. And I want to highlight something that you've said. You know, we talk a lot about community and what community means to us. And very early in your story, you talked about how organizing community has always been your anthem. And it's always been the thing that was really important to you. And then again, when we started talking about Heart Camp, you talked about how it was an instant community and it was something that felt right and it felt inviting to you. Now, I'd like to just provide a little bit of outside perspective. You talk about being kind of physically imposing and gravitating towards being a wallflower. I have seen that side of you, but that is also not the side of you that I have seen in relation to Heart Camp and the people involved in this space, which has been really cool because I think that you also have found a level of safety and security, which has allowed you to kind of open up a little bit more and be a little bit more who you are, which has been really cool. And I think that that is different. And I think, you know, we've talked about this a lot offline, obviously, but when we came into this relationship and even throughout the duration of our marriage up until this point, it's always been your friends and my friends. And this space is really the first time that we now have our friends, which has been a really cool way to also create community around like ourselves, our marriage, our house, our relationship. So I was just wondering if you had any thoughts about that.
It definitely ends up being a case where I've learned to construct community differently according to, I mean, context, obviously. Like I said, I started playing Magic, a card game for the uninitiated, in middle school. And that's, you know, I'm still actively playing it. I have a tattoo of it on my body. There's, I don't know how much more of a, you know, lifelong decision you can make for that. But it's something where that's always been a community I've had that has had essentially forced interaction. Sure. So you go to tournaments, you go sit at a table, the computer tells you who you're playing, blah, 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 and you keep doing that stuff. But again, similar to some of the conversation I've had with my buddy on my other podcast, I don't like interacting with people to trade just because it becomes too cumbersome and too, it just becomes a pain in the butt for me, which again goes back to a lot of non-forced interaction or kind of just mutual communication. And it just ends up being a case where it's, again, the antithesis of the wallflower nature that I tend to have. But then also playing hockey for a large number of years in my life. And it's always like, okay, you show up, play as an adult, you hang around for beers after a game, and then you go home, stuff like that. And so it's not something that was optional interaction inside the same community. It was right. Like you just, it was kind of all the steps were laid out for you. So the difference with Heart Camp ends up being a case where everybody is there for the same reasons, same intentions, or not same, but I should say similar reasons, similar intentions, but all the communication, all the relationships are kind of like optional or ad hoc. Mm-hmm. At that point. So a lot of it is based on, you know, what you want to share.
Yeah.
And absolutely. So there ends up being a case where in the Facebook group that got created beforehand, like Sarah Messily from season one, like she shared, like, I'm coming down from San Diego, or I'll be coming up from San Diego. This is me. This is what I'm dealing with. This is why I'm coming, blah, blah, blah. And so that gave us a reason to connect there, or something where I was able to kind of connect with her both in session and out of session to know like some of the stuff that she was dealing with, and some of the other people kind of shared things there. So it ended up being a case of having that where you're not, it's not just like there were no ridiculous icebreakers lack of anything else, but it was a case where based on what you shared and kind of what you were going through, the more kind of you peeled away the layers of your own onion, it made people kind of like attracted to it, but also want to peel theirs too and everything. So that was my main intention or kind of my main discovery for that.
Absolutely. That makes total sense to me. I know on other podcasts and on my podcast, we spoke a lot about the Enneagram. For anyone who knows you and doesn't assume you're two, they need to know you better. Is there anything that you want to speak to on the Enneagram or what that means to you or how you've used that in context at all this year?
It ends up being something for me that is a tool to understand, again, all of the reasoning behind, you know, the drive for community, how I came up and all of that stuff. So I haven't done as much digging into either of the wings or a lot of the other, how you interact with all the different other numbers yet. Because again, for me, if that's the case, if I'm figuring that out, it's because I want to take care of the other numbers and figure out how I interact with those people to make it the most positive reaction and stuff like that. So for me, it's mostly been almost like a gym plan or an exercise plan for the personality or soul or emotional grid to be able to figure out, you know, why I react certain ways, my default responses to certain things. So sure. Conditioning yourself in, you know, in the physical sense, you have, you know, fast twitch muscle fibers, slow twitch muscle fibers, blah, blah, blah. And you do different things to train them separately. And so now I understand how to train the different parts of my emotional spectrum differently to figure that out. So it just ends up being a case where it was being a two and being, for folks that aren't familiar with the Enneagram by this point, being one that is known as the giver, or colloquially coming across as I'm not okay unless you're okay, it ends up being a case where it's often the two is, you know, thought of as being a pushover or taken advantage of or whatever. But to me, it ends up coming around to more of a Zen-like mentality, where it's very funny, based off of the Good Place episode that we just watched earlier today, where the character constantly says, like, well, that's okay. Like, if that's what he needs, that's, you know, perfectly fine, when they were taking advantage of a guy who was just trying to game the system for points to get into the Good Place. A lot of what that comes around to me ends up being the case. And I talked to Candace about this a lot, and that's, you know, the bulk of that episode there, but it ends up coming around to the type of energy you're putting out into the world. And for me, there's a lot of crossover there into the two-ness and the spirituality aspect of a lot of the things that I have, where it's like, if that's what this person needs right now, then that's perfectly fine. That says nothing about me. That says nothing about how I react to the situation. That says nothing about what I need to do in this instance, but it's, you know, it is what it is. So then let's look at that from both an objective and a subjective person, you know, point of view before we do anything about it, and before I let that in me to hurt me.
Yeah, absolutely. And that made me think about something shortly after we met. You said that in different words to me via text when I was back in my college town reuniting with some friends, and you basically had assessed that, you know, I was feeling uneasy because the people around me were not fully taken care of, and that there was some uneasiness there. And that was before we spoke the Enneagram language, and before I realized how similar you were to me. But it just, looking back, it seems really interesting to think about how all those years ago, and after only knowing me a short while, like, you were able to pinpoint that quality of me, but also what that says about you too. So it's just an interesting reflection that I had.
And having so many people, or it's been interesting to see the number of folks we've talked to here, and then even just with the larger Heart Camp community, the numbers that come out across the board, and having a very kind of a heat map-esque sense of being much closer to the two and four side of things than a lot of the areas. There's been some folks who have been sevens and sixes, and then ones or nines and stuff like that. But the majority of folks that we've talked to, or that we know of, and kind of the Enneagram speaking folks are generally tend to be more twos and fours.
Yeah.
At least more outward with their type.
So besides the Anthologies of Hope, are there any other projects that you have recently completed or that are in the works, or things that you are currently daydreaming about that you'd like to bring to fruition in 2019?
The biggest thing that we're focusing on right now, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily call it a project, but I mean, our daughter is coming soon. So whatever that ends up being a case there. So I'm sure that will take up a good number.
Operation Childbirth.
Exactly. I'm sure that will bring much, much focus and determination for time schedule. But just looking to again, grow Anthologies of Hope and just get the stories that into the ears of the people that it needs to be there. Possibly looking at starting up a blog side of things, where, again, for folks that are guests on here or that are friends of the podcast and things that want to share.
For folks who find it way easier to read articles than to listen to podcasts like your wife.
Exactly. Similarly, where having podcasts and writing and listening to podcasts, I'm perfectly fine to have audio content, but then when I'm doing work and I want to find resources for something, I hate when I click on something and it's a video. So, you know, take it or leave it. but then, you know, partnering based off of being both located in Chicago, doing a lot of work with Hope for the Day, both volunteering as time permits, either pre or post baby. But then also I would, as I mentioned before, there's proactive suicide training that Hope for the Day puts on through peerprevention.org. As you can sign up if you're in the area or even travel. There have been folks that have come, I believe, from Minnesota, and then our friend came from Ohio. But I would like to start teaching some of those classes. So I don't know what that needs to do. So I've been looking for certification in the mental health first aid space there. There just hasn't been anything that has been in the area that has been amenable to our schedule yet. But getting certification in that, as we both have physical first aid training, which we got on the day that we were in our first and only ever Uber accident, but also that was one that was not recorded, where we just got rear-ended and then they're like, okay, there's nothing there, and we drove off. But hey, that's Chicago driving downtown.
God, I forgot about that.
But so again, mental health first aid training, and then just, you know, looking to grow and do a lot of the stuff with Hope for the Day. They have a lot of awesome resources. Based on the day we're recording this, former President Barack Obama had, you know, tweeted about Johnny and the Sip of Hope mission that they have and all the great work that they're doing there. So hopefully that'll give them a good bump. Will pale in comparison to a lot of the impact that would have as far as getting this in front of eyeballs and into ears. But we'll see how that goes. But I mean, mostly just trying to grow that mission, keep that conversation going, and both meeting people where they're at and making sure that they know resources are there is kind of the two biggest projects.
And those all sound, you know, very important. And along that same note, you talked about going through some training and possibly taking up a even bigger role in the mental health community and in the community with your friends and family. What ways do you continue self-care in order to not be consumed by other people's challenges and issues and heartache and pain? I know that that's really difficult and something that both of our inner empaths have struggled with. So in what ways do you take care of yourself?
The biggest thing that I have found for me for self-care, and it's one that, I mean, isn't necessarily surprising in any way, shape, or form, but it's definitely physical exercise.
Sure.
Having grown up playing hockey, I started playing hockey when I was 5. I mean, that ends up being a great release, and it's one that I've conditioned to kind of become as a norm. So going to the gym and, you know, similar to Jenny bearing the lead in her episode and dealing with body dysmorphia, I've always had body image issues as well as a weird relationship with food based off of, for lack of anything else, kind of raising myself on a certain number of meals or not necessarily having a great amount of a rigorous schedule to eat around.
Yeah.
So I've always dealt with that, and I've thrived in areas where I've had a lot of structure so that I could then structure my meals around it. So that's, you know, come and gone, but I've lost a lot of weight after college when I was able to structure exercise into my daily regimen and kind of structured eating. But I've also teetered on, I would say, probably some eating disorder like activity in some of the period I was training, where I was doing a lot of running, but then I was basically subsisting on, you know, Slim Fast and Coke Zero at certain times, which obviously is not healthy. But now, like, I've got a good balance of that between what is a proper diet, what are healthy foods, the fact that you can eat enough healthy foods and still lose weight and things like that. So the combination of eating right and then doing physical health, which is, you know, so simple, but also somebody who, my body can still do all the things I want it to. I just need to have the will to do it.
That's nice.
When it was, I want to say, yeah, it was 2000, spring of 2004, because I was interning in North Carolina. And I was watching, there was a, I don't know why it was on at this time, but I was, you know, home watching something on a Friday night and, you know, fell asleep on the couch, woke up at 2 a.m. and Oprah was on. But it was the episode of Oprah with Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst for, I want to say, Spider-Man 3. It could have been Spider-Man 2 at the time. I don't remember. We don't need to IMDb it. Oprah asked him how he looked so good in the movie, and he was like, he found the two secret things to, you know, feeling great and looking great. And like, Oprah got up on the edge of her seat and was like, well, what is it? Tell me. And he's like, eat right, exercise more. And it looked like she wanted to slap him. And that was probably like the only time I've ever seen it look like Oprah wanting to slap someone. but it, you know, it got a laugh. And, but that's one of the things that always stuck in my mind, that even when I fall like out of sync or anything there, it ends up being a case where I know, like, if I'm not adhering to one of those, it's not going to be a case where I'm seeing progress in any form of one or the other. So I don't beat myself up when I don't see the results that I'm expecting or that I'm in a place where I need to be. So those are the two big things there. Again, magic is a great one for me to be able to escape mentally. Magic is a great one to be able to escape mentally and just coming in and going, and either whether it's in, you know, smaller tournaments or just connecting with a community that I see every so often, and just when I'm in the middle of a game, just being able to space out and focus on that specifically. I mean, in more recent years, definitely going to therapy, where similar to the conversation here that we end up having every week with folks, it ends up being a case where I'm able to have those conversations, and I don't really plan on ever saying any, I don't really have many topics going into. And again, this is the do as I say, not as I do type thing, because with all of our friends, including you, I'm saying like, yeah, you should talk to your counselor, you should talk to your therapist about that. I never really have topics going in, but then she's always like, well, let's talk about this, or what do you think about this, or what's going on? And then it ends up being 45 minutes later and when we're done for the day, and well, I haven't stopped talking.
I mean, that's a good point. And you bring up an important point about forming a relationship with a counselor or with a therapist, is that even if you don't go in, I mean, yes, there are definitely times I go to counseling and I have 2 pages worth of things I want to talk about, but there are other times where the conversation takes me. And I think that those are the things that you don't even realize you want to talk about or should talk about. So I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. And I know that every time you come home, you always seem a little bit lighter than when you left. Yeah. And I think that that's a good thing too.
And another big thing I didn't want to miss as far as going back to the physical activity, I've never really been a runner, but this year I was training for a Tough Mudder, a 10-mile Tough Mudder, where I just kind of jumped in based off of implied peer pressure, but more entirely FOMO for some friends doing it in the area. And so the longest I'd ever run at a single clip was about 4 miles. And so this was a 10-miler. So I was like, hey, it makes sense to let me just do a half marathon training program. So the fact that we live so close to Lake Michigan, it was one where it made sense to do some training on the lake. And I found over the course of the summer, when I was doing some long runs with, you know, the, you know, same shit, different day work bullshit that everybody has, or anything that we were trying to figure out here that just wasn't coming together, or frustration through our IVF journey or anything like that, there was a lot that would like build up over the course of the day. And then I'd get ready, get everything, go out and just go for a run and go along the lake. And then by the time I was done or coming back, like, it was all abated. Like, it was gone. Like, there just was nothing there.
It cleared your head.
And so, yeah, it definitely gave me the time, the focus, where when you're in the middle of it, it seems like a massive idea and a massive problem. Yeah. But then when you have time, distance, and context, and you've, you know, got some of those endorphins in you, they seem so much smaller, which is, for me, it ended up being a case where I was happy when we saw your and our heroes speak not too long ago in a room with Glennon Doyle, Abby Wambach, Sophia Bush, and some other folks that I've since started following on social media that are pretty amazing. But it was something that Glennon had said when somebody had asked her a question. I don't remember who, but the basic setup was like, what's one thing that you end up having, or that, you know, a life lesson type thing. And for her, it was that there is something called save as draft, because she was sending emails that was, you know, she started working with one of the people on stage, and with the email she was sending, she was just, you know, burning shit to the ground. And so for me, that's what running became the save as draft button, because I'd leave here with a head full of shit and, you know, tons of mental emails already written and conversations I was going to have, where I'm going to say this, they're going to say this, I'm going to say this, and they're going to say this, and then I'm going to jump down their throat and it's going to be perfect and all this stuff. But then I'd go and run, and then I'd come back and poof, they would all be gone, or just be like just don't deal with it. Right. Like, just let it go, and then it would be fine. So that was another thing as far as both just, you know, normal gym activity, pushing weight, lifting weight, jumping around, bouncing off the wall, but then also just, you know, going and running across the across the lake. That's how fast okay, I'm running. Or just running along the lake.
I mean, you obviously have an incredible story that has a lot of pieces to it. And I know that we just touched the surface of things. If there's one thing that you wanted our listeners to take away from your story or your journey, what would it be?
There ends up being a lot that through the course of my story, I have mantras or I have things that come and go. And even as much as I love yoga, but yoga doesn't currently agree with me. For a couple of reasons, and like they try to figure out some of the mantras. The one that comes to mind there is like, I know who I am and I know who I can be. And so that's one that I use as a mantra for me whenever I need to center myself or kind of figure some shit out or experiencing self-doubt. But as far as the one thing I would want someone to take away is be careful what you wish for, because you just might get it. But you will never be able to get it if you're not here. And so those are in the conversations that I have with people, the conversations we have with friends in crisis, the conversations with friends we know that, or they know that they need help and they're looking for suggestions, basic conversations, introductory conversations. There have been too many countless times, and I understand, you know, coming at this from a place of a certain amount of privilege, that I've been able to achieve that due to that. But it ends up being a case where as much that I've ever wanted to do, as much that I've ever seen myself doing, I've been able to achieve. But if I didn't keep trying, if I didn't keep going, I would never be able to get there, or I would never be able to experience that. And so that may not come the exact way that you're expecting it to, and may not, you know, manifest itself in the exact path that you have. And so, I mean, it's kind of ironic based on some of the stuff that we shared today for one of the interviews that we had with Aaron, where, you know, don't just go by the checklist of life. Like, don't be afraid to get out your metaphorical or literal machete and whack and chop and, you know, cut through your own path, because it may not just be the two paths diverged in a wood by Robert Frost. There's a third path in there that you can make on your own that could be a shorter, longer, more eventful, more fulfilling path that you just don't know about. So it ends up being a case where the path in front of you may not be clear right now, but it will be clear at some point. And so, you know, just be careful what you wish for, because your dreams can and will come true. You just have to be around for them to manifest and for you to keep pushing to get there.
I like that. I like that a lot. And then I know one of your favorite things, you're probably one of the most musically related. No, that's not the right word. You're one of the most
inclined,
motivated and moved by music people that I know. And, you know, I remember the first couple months of our friendship, before it was even a relationship, we used to send song lyrics back and forth or make playlists for each other. So in that spirit, what would be the one or two at most songs that you want to add this week to the Anthologies of Hope playlist?
And I understand now, getting asked this question, why it's such a loaded question. And so now going forward, I will have more fun asking people with it, because I do understand how much of an arm twisting question it is. And so it's not one that I know I'm ever going to be satisfied with the answer.
Correct.
And so that there's a handful of folks that, I mean, I've loved all of their choices so far, but I mean, they're probably now face palming once they're listening to the episode afterwards and seeing some of the things on there. But I mean, I would think the two main ones that, and it was even with another episode, I don't know what order they'll come in, where I tend to take a lot out of song lyrics more so than other folks, or just kind of look at them and pull them out as maybe even, you know, sub snippets of stuff. And it may be based off of the recent viewing of one of your Christmas presents to me, But I think there's going to be two Volbeat songs that are they're going on here. So similar to the episode that'll be going up next week as of when we're recording this, and adding some of the heavier stuff to Kenneth's playlist selection and my selection for his episode as well. But there's two Volbeat songs that are very key for this, one being Heaven Nor Hell, where it ends up being a case for me, what I take away from that song. I just love anything that has a lot of drums and heavy guitars in it. But it ends up being a case where if you live your life according to, you know, just going to heaven or avoiding hell or any of that stuff, like, you're forgetting the point of existence that we're here. Like, we need to be here to live. We need to be here to love. We need to be here to, you know, share it with each other. And that's kind of the main point of the song and my takeaway, where it's like, yeah, that's fine. You can have all that stuff, but I'm just going to do what I can while I'm here. And that's where I'm going to last. And then the other one, which, the title is kind of misleading, but it's Goodbye Forever. And it's a case where when you listen to it, it's kind of a corollary to Heaven or Hell, but they're on, you know, they're on albums like 5 years apart or something. So they're not anything close, but it ends up being a case where it's like, all the stuff that you want in life is right outside the door. Like, if you want to see the light, open the curtains. If you want to feel the love, step outside, type things. So much so that on the concert DVD that you got me for Christmas, and it's rather unfortunate based on the way they cut the songs and cut some of the break there, but they dedicated that song on the recording at the concert to Chris Cornell and Chester Bennington, who, you know, we've lost in the past 18-ish months. So, I mean, so those are two where when they're just excellent high up-tempo songs and just heavy hitting and are great. You know, I don't remember the type of song it is, but I'm also, I can see the exact episode of Glee where he tells them the type of songs that they're looking for. Ballads. There we go. It's a great metal ballad of telling stories and things like that. But I mean, when you just look at the lyrics, it's just plain as day. It's like, you know, live your life, be a good person. When you need help, ask for it, and people will be there to support you. And so those are, you know, some of those things there where, again, you may not like metal music, but it's there. As a metalhead, you know, some of the most profound music I found has been Lady Gaga songs. And so it's like, you know, step outside your comfort zone, listen to the lyrics and do it. So those would be my two based off of the amount of emotion where, you know, when I was watching that earlier today, by the end of Goodbye Forever on the concert DVD, I was just sitting on the couch in my bear suit crying. So that was probably an awkward moment for you to walk in on. But other than that, not too much. Those would be my two entries for this week. So since I usually add an episode, we'll flip the script and say, what would your song for this week, for your interview of me this week be?
I wasn't prepared for that question, but Days Like This.
Amaryllis?
Yes.
Depending on when this goes out, that was one where I don't know how long. Well, I would say probably not how long, because we already had the first name picked out, but that was something where, as far as a name for a child of some sort, but it ends up being a case where with the main lyric that I have tattooed on my right wrist is just, you know, says Days Like This. So it's, there's good days, there's bad days, the good days pull you through the bad days keep you level on the good days. And you know that it's never going to be over. You just have to keep pushing through. Thank you so very much for joining us this week. We hope you had as good a time listening as we had recording the interview. Don't forget to check out anthologiesofhope.com/playlist for all the awesome songs that will get added each week. You can find us on social media at Anthologies of Hope on Facebook and Instagram, and Anthologies Pod on Twitter. It would be great if you could subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or Google, and leave us a review. As always, remember, everyone has a story, and it's about time we start listening.